Radio Netherlands presents The Research File with Laura Denford.
Hello. We humans are big-brained creatures, and one thing that happens as a result is learning. But how do we learn? What should we learn, and why should we learn? We've got a few specific suggestions coming up shortly. To begin with, though, a problem that can persist when one of life's early lessons doesn't get learned quite thoroughly enough.
Mommy!
Come on, little girl. Let's get your nappy off, eh?
Here's your potty.
No!
Come on, honey, it's time to sit on the potty.
No!
Have a wee wee and you'll feel better for that, won't you?
No!
Toilet training a toddler is not always fun, but at least for most people it pays off, learning to control the bladder. But there's a surprisingly large number of adults, as well as older children, who have difficulty with this, usually at night time in particular. In fact, a recently completed epidemiological study revealed that as many as 1 in 200 adults have problems with nocturnal enuresis, the official name for bedwetting. Dr. Frank van Leerdam has spent around 11 years studying the phenomenon and recently completed a PhD. So I went to the Department of Public and Occupational Health at the Free University of Amsterdam to ask him what we now know about the causes of bedwetting.
There are several possible causes. The psychological part is always said to be a major factor. We discovered that it's the other way around. Psychological problems do not cause bedwetting. Bedwetting causes psychological problems.
What about other possibilities like infections or blockages in the actual urinal tract itself?
About 3% of the bedwetters are caused by a problem like blockades in the urinary tract. Infection is often said. That is the case in children in hospitals, but it's one of the points we found in our epidemiological studies, that there is no relation between urine tract infections and bedwetting at all in a normal population.
Okay, so that seems to rule out two of the usual arguments, which leaves actual sort of, if you like, physiological, biological causes that may be underlying this, and you've investigated those as well, haven't you? What did you find?
Well, we know from history that the genes are an important factor. If both of your parents have bedwetting, then you as a child has a chance of 77% to be a bedwetter also. If only one of your parents has bedwetting, then the chance diminishes to about 40%. And when none of your parents has bedwetting, then you get 18% in boys and 10% in girls at the age of 5. So that the genes are important. But there are other factors also. In some children, the hormones. Each of us makes a hormone during the evening, which allows our body to make less urine during nights, so we can sleep through the night. Well, a group of children don't make the hormone enough, or they do make hormone enough, but not at the right time of the day.
So this is antidiuretic hormone, ADH. So I guess that links back to the genetic factor that you were just talking about.
Yes, part of it relates to the genetic factor. In fact, it is a problem of your development. You can compare it with children who are not able to cycle in time. There are children who cycle very early, at the age of 3 can cycle without problem, and there are children who don't master this phenomenon, cycling, at the age of 6. Well, that's the same with those hormones. It's a development process in your brain. Some children early master the phenomenon of listening to your bladder, making the hormone at the right time, going on the right time to the toilet. It's a complex process.
Now, you mentioned listening to your bladder, and I know from my own experience there are times when I'm asleep when maybe I start dreaming about going to the toilet. So I guess that's perhaps a factor as well, learning to listen to your body even while you're asleep.
Exactly, this is probably the most important factor, to learn to listen to the signals from your body. That's probably also why girls are less bedwetters than boys. Girls listen better to the signals from their own body. In the bedwetters, the major problem is arousal. they get the signal, but they get a lot of signals, and they don't wake up from that signal as they should. And what you have to do is train them to recognize the signal.
Okay, and that leads us to another part of what you've been working on, which is a kind of a practical approach to tackling at least some of the causes for bedwetting. So tell me more about your alarming knickers.
It's an apparatus that has been known for many years, but it's not well researched. The good alarms are knickers, which are connected to a device. And when the child starts to urinate, the device goes off. The ions in the urine makes connection into electrodes to sensors, and they send a signal to the apparatus.
And we've got one of the little boxes here, so maybe we can hear what that sounds like.
Well, I'm not going to pee into my pants, but we have a trick here. We can connect the sensors to themselves.
Okay, well, it certainly would wake me up, I think.
In fact, you are awake when you wet your bed, but the bedwetters fell asleep immediately after that. And what this apparatus does is it gives an extra stimulus during the waking up.
So you've actually been testing this, I think, to see how effective a treatment it really is, haven't you?
Yes, we have been testing it in a group of children, and we have checked 2 years later if they are still dry. And we found that not only it works very well immediately when you start to train, we knew that already from other studies, but it's still, after 2 years' time, about 70% of the children is still dry, and that's very good. It's better than anything else. With the normal things every parent does, we know that the spontaneous cure rate is about 15% each year. So in 2 years' time, about 30%. This is 70%, so much better.
So that addresses the training aspect and the waking up aspect of the problem. Is there anything that can be done to tackle the more, if you like, biological underpinnings of bedwetting to do with the hormones and the responsiveness to hormones and so on?
Well, even the alarm treatment has biological impact, we discovered. You can store a bigger amount of urine in your bladder after the alarm treatment. But on the hormones, there is a synthetic hormone, and you can give that to children, and then they become dry. The problem is, if you stop the drugs, the children are wet again. And that's why we say first alarm treatment, and only in special cases, as part of the complete treatment, you can use drugs.
Dr. Frank van Leerdam. And there'll be further information on our webpages about all that next week. Now, childhood is the time when we learn the most, of course, absorbing information from the world around. And children need a lot of sleep, too, a lot more than adults, up to 16 hours a day. Perhaps that's necessary to somehow help to consolidate all of those everyday learning experiences. Some research has indeed indicated that there is such a connection between the two activities, but scientists would love to be able to understand the relationship much better. And, funnily enough, children have never been the subjects of research until now. The Great Sleep Experiment was a world first in sleep and learning research, and it happened recently in the Nemo Science Centre in Amsterdam. A class of Dutch schoolchildren had won a national competition, and their prize was to participate in this serious research experiment as the guinea pigs. My colleague, Willemien Groot, went along to find out more.
When the kids entered Science Center Nemo, they thought we're going to have fun, and it's only fun and only fun. And we explained to them that it was a real important experiment, so important that even two researchers from the United States had flown over to witness it. And the kids were so conscious of that, that they made the computer tests very silent and concentrated. And when we said to them by 11 at night, well, now it's time to go to sleep, they all did so.
Dr. Eus van Someren is a psychophysiologist with the Netherlands Institute for Brain Research, based in Amsterdam. He was also the leader of the Great Sleep Experiment, in which 32 10 to 13-year-old pupils from the first Montessori school in the town of Hoofddorp participated. The purpose of the experiment was to investigate how sleep may affect our ability to learn.
In the last 10 years, more and more results indicate that sleep has a special role for learning, especially to consolidate what you have learned on day one, and then you sleep. Then you know sometimes even better than on day one what you've learned. What is it in sleep that causes that relation? This is somewhat difficult to find in adults. We haven't really been successful to dissect which stages of sleep are important and which brain activity is important. What we know of kids is that they can learn very, very well. What we also know is that their sleep is very clear. If you look at their brain EEG, you see those special waves associated with sleep very clearly. So we thought it might be in kids that you have a sort of magnifying glass. Learning is more prominent, sleep is more prominent. Maybe we can find out more about what's the relation between those two.
In the experiment, the children spend a day learning particular groups of words, or practicing a certain sequence of letters on a computer keyboard, and being tested. Then they slept overnight in the science center. Most of them wore headphones while they slumbered, and electrical sensors that were stuck to their eyelids and foreheads. Others were there to help monitor the experiment and see what brainwave showed up on the electroencephalogram, or EEG.
We saw when they were not in sleep and when they were in deep sleep, that you could see on the computer. You can see when she's dreaming and when she's awake. And she's talking and she's whispering with her eyes. All that things you can see on the computer.
Okay, wat we zien is het eerste stukje. Dat is van een dopje wat midden op je hoofd zat.
Trained researchers were around to assist the children and to explain what was going on during the experiment. During the night, brain activity of the sleeping children was continuously monitored and analyzed online.
We always knew at every 2-second interval whether there was deep sleep or superficial sleep. And as soon as a kid went into deep sleep, a small beep was played on a headphone. And the aim we had with that is to selectively suppress deep sleep in part of the children and see whether this made any difference for their performance the next day.
The whole field of sleep research is very young, especially considering that we spend 1/3 of our lives asleep. But what scientists have found so far is that although we certainly do learn without the need for sleep, a good night's rest does often help to improve the learning process. Dr. Robert Stickgold is Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School in the USA. He's long been involved in investigating the connections between sleep and learning.
We've had two tasks now. One, a motor task, a behavioral skill task, where you learn to type in a certain way. And the other, a visual discrimination task, a perception task. And in both of these, it turns out that after you train on this task, if we retest you the same day, you don't show any obvious improvement as a result of having been trained. But if we wait until after you've had a night of sleep before we test you, then we see a marked improvement. So there's a kind of learning that happens while you're asleep. And in that particular case, it only happens while you sleep. And if you lose the first night of sleep after we train you, subsequent nights of sleep can't replace it.
All Professor Stickgold's research to date has involved studying adults. He came to Amsterdam to observe the Great Sleep Experiment because he recognized the unique opportunity that it presented. He anticipates that because youngsters require so much more sleep than adults, their ability to learn and remember new information will be more dependent upon sleep.
What I hope to find from this experiment is what we did wrong in studying children. No one in the world has ever looked at sleep and memory in anyone under the age of 18, probably, whereas it's obviously so critical in their lives. So as a scientist, when you run your first experiment, what you hope you'll find is what you need to do differently next time. If we're lucky, the effects are so strong that we'll see some sleep-dependent improvement on some of these tasks, despite the fact that we undoubtedly did it wrong.
A full analysis of the results of the Great Sleep Experiment has not yet been completed, although the initial indications were that some children did perform better on their computerized test after a good night's sleep as compared with the day before. But whatever the scientific outcome, the experiment has at least helped to strengthen professional ties between Dr. Eus van Someren in Amsterdam and Professor Stickold in Harvard.
My ultimate desire is that these data will provide enough evidence of the importance of the study that I can go back home to Harvard and get funding to actually start studying children. It would be a wonderful thing to get to do.
Robert Stickgold ending that report by Willemien Groot. And there's more about that research on the Radio Netherlands website this week, www.researchfile.nl. Now, from finding out how we learn to thinking about what we ought to learn about from a young age. Symmetry is the somewhat surprising topic I heard recommended recently by Nobel Prize-winning physicist and science educator Leon Lederman. Take a ball and rotate it by 45 degrees, it will look the same as before. Or cut it in half and the two pieces are identical. A sphere is an obvious example of something that shows symmetry in various ways. But Professor Lederman is talking about symmetry in much less obvious ways, symmetry as it relates to the world of maths and physics. He says that if things don't change, even when the circumstances around them do change, then you call that a symmetry. And, he says, in the early 20th century, scientists recognised that the laws of physics remain the same, regardless of any changes in the ways that you look at them. So that means there's a symmetry underlying the universe itself. Professor Lederman has recently co-authored a book on this subject, and central to the story is a gifted but largely unrecognised female mathematician called Emmy Noether. She did her most significant work in 1915.
She recognised that any physical system that has a symmetry must also have a conservation law. So let me tell you what a conservation law is. So they have a big box. And in that box, there are all kinds of things. Nuclear explosions are taking place. Springs are vibrating. Clocks are going. It turns out that there's a single number which you derive by examining all of these funny objects. And that number never changes. It was called energy. And the law was that the total energy of a system doesn't change. It's conserved. And that statement by Emmy Noether's theorem could be related to something about how you do experiments in time. It says that if two observers are doing experiments to discover laws of physics, that the laws of physics will not change if one observer starts at 12 o'clock and the other observer starts at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That time is like a smooth flow, and it doesn't matter when you start or when you finish. The symmetry with respect to the flow of time is directly related to the law of conservation of energy. In the same way, there were several other symmetries, like the laws of physics are independent of any particular direction in space. And that gives rise to the law of conservation of angular momentum. It's the kind of thing you see when a dancer spreads her arms out and twirls around, and as she draws her arms close to her body, she speeds up to blinding rotation. That's the law of conservation of angular momentum. These are important ideas, and they tell us something about the world in which we live, the space of the world and the time of the world. They give meaning to those concepts.
And that relates to symmetry, because as you change something, like the rate at which you spin if you're a skater, the laws of physics don't change. It's not been affected by the sort of operation you perform.
Yeah, the symmetry usually is in the space. The conservation is something else. What Emmy does is add to the intuitive symmetrical things, the symmetrical temple, the symmetrical sphere, if you like. It adds a quality of conservation. And there are many, many other examples of symmetries. For example, in 1927, a physicist by the name of Dirac, in trying to make a theory of the electron, and try to make that electron consistent with Einstein's theory of relativity, made an interesting discovery. His equation said you can't have an electron without having its twin, a positive electron. And this gave rise to the notion of antimatter. There's a symmetry between matter and antimatter. And sure enough, every one of those antiparticles was eventually found in nature. And it came out of the equations, out of the symmetry of the equations. That was quite an amazing thing.
So you think that by teaching the history of symmetry, facts about symmetry, and some of these things that have come out of symmetry, it will basically help to give people a more general insight into the world around them, but also a deeper understanding of scientific issues as well.
Exactly right. You want to bring it in from the earliest stage with the simplest examples of the kind of symmetry which artists appreciate and which architects appreciate when you look at things, and which is part of nature. Nature is full of symmetrical things. Think of snowflake, beautiful six-fold symmetry of a snowflake. What is it? It's water, but it's water crystallized into a incredibly beautiful symmetric form. Think about seashells that have symmetries. Most animals and minerals and so on carry symmetries of various kinds. What's curious is that it's never brought up. I've looked at dozens and dozens of high school and middle school textbooks in science, and even first year university textbooks, and symmetry is never in there. And yet we know it for a long time. We know how important it is in science. And we know that if your mind can absorb that property of symmetry, and there are neuroscientists who tell me that the mind is specially sensitive to concepts of symmetry, that your comfort level in the world goes up, that you can recognize situations in which symmetry plays a role. I mean, there's handedness, left-handed and right-handed. We used to be prejudiced against left-handers, and we were forcing these poor children to try to write with their right hands when they were naturally left-handed. Well, I mean, there's a good example where a sense of symmetry would have saved that situation because it was so ridiculous. Many, many examples that would infiltrate you when you were trying to make some reasonable decision on a complicated issue and where you wanted to use logic but you didn't quite know how, a sense of symmetry would save you and say, aha, I think it's symmetrical to go this way.
Why do you think it is that symmetry isn't included in education at the moment?
I think it's a question of the fact that education as a system is notoriously resistant to change, at least in the U.S., and I think it's not so different in other countries. The curriculum hasn't changed in 100 years, in spite of the incredible changes that have taken place in the 20th century science. Teachers have difficulty in keeping up. It's not their fault, it just things change. And the schools don't change to accommodate them. And I think symmetry has now grown, we're using it more and more over the past almost 100 years. And I'm trying personally to see if I can infiltrate that and get people to say, oh my God, you know, we've left this out.
Leon Lederman. And his book is called Symmetry and the Beautiful Universe, published by Prometheus Books. I met Professor Lederman at a recent conference called Building the Scientific Mind, which I've reported on just a few weeks ago, you may recall. One of the other people I met there was Federico Mayor, a former politician. He's also been Director General of the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, and is now President of the Foundation for a Culture of Peace, based in Spain. But Dr. Mayor is also a biochemist by training, and he has some ideas about why people of all ages and at all levels in society need to learn about science.
The use of transgenics, the ozone layer, the climate change, the mad cows, the avian flu, there are so many issues that are really of key importance today for the world of the normal citizen, that we cannot expect the decision makers to take the right decisions only with a political feeling or views. And it is for this that scientific rigor today is particularly important at the highest level of governance.
You're not necessarily suggesting that everybody in the world should know everything there is to know about science. So it's not necessarily the detailed knowledge that you're talking about. It's a kind of attributes, abilities of the mind, I guess. So what would be those key abilities as far as you're concerned?
I think that the most important challenge in this respect is to make available in a way that everybody can understand what scientific knowledge means and to have the rigor of science. And we will have so many advantages. And also the citizens, we, the normal people, we could understand the benefits and also the shortcomings of knowledge, of science, and then, therefore, we could intervene directly. We can be better democracy builders because our participation will be based on rigor and not only sometimes on our heart. And it's for this that I think that having, from the very beginning in the schools, in all the levels, to have this science-minded education is extremely relevant.
Now, I think that when you put a scientific mind in the context of trying to improve people's abilities in a democratic process, it sounds great. But what kind of mechanisms or steps would you like to see take place to try and help facilitate some of these ideas?
First of all, education is very different from to have abilities or to be a specialist in one given aspect of science. Education is to be able to be yourself, to be able to argue in favor of your views, to listen the other views. This is education, and this is one aspect. The second part, I believe that for this process, we need to have all the elements of this process of education. Normally, we only talk about the schools. The communication media in general are absolutely essential. We need more than ever today to be interactive, to attract the attention of the people for the scientific aspects.
Are you aware of any moves that are currently afoot or maybe about to be set in place to make a framework for these things to happen in the future?
Well, in fact, I am working for a culture of peace. I mean, I think that is so clear that we must all together, the citizens, the media, all those that realize that now we must change. And at the end of the 80s, something happened that, in my view, is a shame for the humanity as a whole. Because we had our principles, universal principles, the human rights, freedom, equality, justice, solidarity. And suddenly, we were told by the richest countries in the world that now what really matters here is the market. And the market has said that now the gap between the haves and the haves not, instead of narrowing, has been widening. And this is what is leading to many young people to be completely indifferent, because they realize that we are not thinking in their future. I think that is in this context that I consider that a scientific-minded education, scientific rigor, elements for decision-making at the level of the parliaments and of the governments is more necessary and urgent than ever. And it's for this that I'm hopeful, because I know that we have a distinctive capacity of the human beings that is to invent. And we must now invent a new world for our children and their children.
Federico Maior. And that's bringing an end to today's learning experience that has been The Research File. Next week, there'll be another chance to hear a special edition of the programme commemorating the life and work of that great iconic scientist, Albert Einstein. But in the meantime, don't forget that there's more on our website this week and next week about bedwetting and the Great Sleep Experiment. The address again is www.researchfile.nl. So, until next time, from me, Laura Durnford, bye for now.
The Research File is a Radio Netherlands presentation.